All right, here we go. It's Monday, and it's the 1st of March. God, we are coming up on the one-year anniversary of the world coming apart.
You okay we don't celebrate that one around?
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, man. Monday, March 1st. Does that mean we're out of the woods?
Well, it means it's March, and which is better than February.
Yeah, does that mean we're out of winter?
Which is better than January?
Yeah.
No, we're not. No, it's not. No, March is coming in like a lion today, as you may have noticed.
Yes.
It's a little blustery out there today, but...
Blustery, flurries, and still in lockdown.
Normally, I don't root for pages to come off the calendar. It's a bad thing because you only got so many. but yeah, every month that passes seems like potentially a good thing that we are closer to that day of liberation, whenever that might happen.
You know, people keep talking about it's Arash Madani, Stephen Brun. We're with you until 7 o'clock. We are keeping the seat warm for the next week. Tim and Friends begins next Monday. Congratulations to McAuliffe and Sixero on a heck of a run and a great final week. We're with you 5 to 7 through Friday. We have a real busy show coming up. But somebody said to me, you know, the phrase I'm so tired of hearing is the new normal. I'm like, what about the old normal? Is that ever coming back in any way whatsoever, or forget it? I don't know.
Well, grasp a little bits of it when you can. That's all I have to say.
Yeah.
I've been doing my best.
Yeah, we all have. We appreciate you being with us. Our text line is open. We're going to get to that theme in just a minute. There's a lot going on for a Monday, a lot happening for the first day of March. There is a lot not happening in Tampa with the Raptors. You know the game got canceled against the Bulls the other day. They are still shut down. Michael Grange is going to update us on whatever the latest is coming out of Raptors land. I mean, we're talking about a group that gets tested 2 to 3 times a day. They didn't have the required 8 players available to play an NBA game. We'll see if they may even sit out until the All-Star break. We'll see. It's the Leafs and the Oilers again tonight. You can watch the Leafs broadcast on Sportsnet Ontario, Sportsnet East. We'll have it for you on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Austin Matthews, game time decision tonight. Michael Hutchinson in net. No Jack Campbell. Of course, Frederik Andersen is still out. Michael Hutchinson gets the start for the Maple Leafs. Chris Johnston will join us from Hockey Night in Canada.
Man, they were good Saturday.
Yeah.
That was as complete. Didn't take a penalty. Campbell looked really good in net. Didn't have Matthews. Didn't matter. That was a superb kind of that's one of those performances this year and where you could actually kind of, if you're going to dream on the Leafs, winning a playoff series, but doing something in the playoffs, if they can play hockey like that and add it to the kind of offensive firepower they've got, man, oh man, Arash. I actually started to believe there for a couple of hours on Saturday.
No kidding.
Yeah, no, that was because they're, you know, the Oilers have been playing great.
Sure.
And the Leafs are undermanned, and it was a complete 60 minutes of, 60 minutes of really good hockey.
Well, let's get to this text. Let's get to the text line. Let's open it up. Star 590. Dylan, let's open up the text line. Okay, great. Done. If you are starting an NHL team today, and we have the Leafs and the Oilers tonight, let's take McDavid out of the equation, remove Austin Matthews from the conversation. Those are the easy ones. If you're starting an NHL team today, besides those two, and you get the number one overall pick in a dispersal draft, in an expansion draft. If you're Seattle and everybody's available to you, if you're going to build a franchise around, who are you going to do it? You can't pick McDavid. You can't pick Matthews. Who are you going to pick? Text it to Star 590. We will read that as the afternoon and evening goes on. Also to, sorry, 590, 590, not Star 590. Let's text 590, 590, excuse me. I'm an idiot. And we also had baseball.
Yes. Yes, we had baseball, the actual Grapefruit League opener yesterday. Game 2 today against the mighty Pittsburgh Pirates. A 6.5 inning ball game. I haven't seen one of those before. A 6.5 inning tie.
Mm.
So, yes, you could have, but in theory, yes, had it been a 7 inning game and one team had been ahead, you could have a 6.5. But no, a 6.5 inning tie. Of course, it's 2021. What else would you have? A 6.5 inning tie in a Grapefruit League game, right?
A 2-all draw that did not go to penalty kicks.
Yeah. Robbie Ray threw strikes. Anthony Alford turned on one of them and hit it out a mile, which, and good for him. We all kind of root for Anthony Alford. Otherwise, Jay's pitching was good. We saw the debut of Austin Martin, and he made two errors in the field at shortstop. So maybe he's not a shortstop. Walked, stole a base. So that's a historic moment potentially. But otherwise, you know, it'll be like, how far are we from actually just kind of settling into Grapefruit League Rush? Like, you know what? Like the first few games, people who are fans are kind of into every at bat and who's pitching and what they look like and what was his velo like.
Mm-hmm.
Then you realize, you know, this actually goes on forever.
Yes.
And it doesn't really matter. And the wins and losses don't matter and people kind of relax into it. But so we have seen, and we saw Nate Pearson today. That is the other kind of signature moment for the Blue Jays, Nate Pearson's 2021 debut.
So it was 1 year ago today. Much simpler times, that myself and Arden Swelling and Alex Kuhn made the drive from Clearwater Beach to Bradenton, and it was Nate Pearson's second big league spring training outing. He didn't start that game. Pearson came in relief, and he hit the radar gun at 100 not once, but twice. And there was a murmur that went through that stadium.
Yep.
Each time the gun hit triple digits. And he kind of had Pirates hitters off balance to the point where he just totally crossed up Josh Bell with an 87-mile-an-hour changeup. Today, Pearson went out there throwing 98, 99, mainly worked fastball slider. And of all the conversations that are going to go on this spring, I really believe the Pearson one is going to be one of the most significant. The Blue Jays are hoping he is going to figure prominently into their pitching staff.
Mm-hmm.
They are hoping he's going to be a franchise cornerstone. And, you know, Pearson said, I worked a lot on my secondary stuff. He said most of the time he worked this offseason was on his curveball. He wants to incorporate the changeup more. 87% of his pitches last year were fastball slider. But I just really think that of all the stories that we're going to see this season, how Vlad evolves as a first baseman with this reshaped body, where Kevin Biggio emerges, is it mainly going to be third base? Can Bo Bichette really cement himself as a franchise shortstop? To me, the Nate Pearson question really is one of the biggest ones in the overall direction of where this franchise
is. I'm going to add one little asterisk to it, though. And I was talking to the morning show guys about this today, because you're right. You know, and he is the best pitcher to come through the Blue Jays system, the most highly touted pitcher to come through their system in quite some time, obviously. And, you know, normally you would just say, okay, there's your, you know, this is a guy you want to be your number one for the next 10 years. And you just slot him in there as the ace in your rotation. He throws, you know, like there are a lot of guys throw high 90s these days. So that's not unusual. But this guy, you know, is going to touch 103 if he ever feels like he can let loose. But here's the one asterisk, Arash. Just the way the pitcher use has evolved in baseball and is evolving very, very, very rapidly. Like, we still tend to think in terms of five-man rotation, innings count, pitch counts. Not necessarily pitcher wins anymore. I don't think anybody looks at that anymore. But we still kind of think of it in that conventional sense. You need your five guys and you roll them out there and everybody gets 5 days, you know, comes on regular rest. Some guys like a little more, some guys like a little less. You know, you hope they pitch deep into a game, and then ideally the bullpen cleans it up at the end, and that's how you win baseball games.
Mm-hmm.
But look at what the Rays did last year with their rotation and the way they handled a good rotation. You know, a really good rotation with Glasnow and Snell and others.
And Morton,
but they, you know, so I think we have to start thinking about different ways the pitcher's going to be used, twice through the order, openers, even with good pitchers. And managing innings and managing pitch counts, not just in terms of a raw number, but in terms of being able to actually try and manage stress, which is what the sports science people try and do, you know, to understand what those pitches and what those innings mean. Like when Aaron Sanchez, remember the year they babied him along, right, and got him to the end of the season, we still talked a lot about innings. How many innings is he going to pitch? How many pitches is he going to throw? But it's way more granular now. And I think the notion of the, you know, the five man rotation and everybody going out and staying out there as long as they can, like, that may already be the past.
Yeah.
And right. So you're looking at some combination of 10 guys up and down throughout the course of the year, ideally. And, you know,
well, let me just stop you there. I think by mid-April, the Blue Jays may very well have used seven, if not eight, different starting pitchers.
Not just because guys can't do it, though, but because that's how you do it now, I think.
And matchup related. They go to Texas the second series of the season. Suddenly you're facing a predominantly left-handed lineup, and that's a big part of it. With Pearson, he said, look, my goals this year, one, get as many innings as I can, two, just stay healthy all year. This is what he said after his one inning of work today.
I mean, I think I'm coming in with the same mentality as last year. You know, it doesn't matter about if I'm in the rotation or not. You know, all that matters is that I get outs and attack the zone and throw strikes. And if I do all those, I think I'll find myself in the rotation. You know, either way, I think just filling up the zone, throwing strikes, only good will come of it.
28 pitches today, 16 strikes, mainly fastball slider. The radar gun was reading 98-99 on the regular. Let's welcome in Ben Wagner, who is in the house for that one at TD Ballpark. Blue Jays play-by-play man. Mr. Wagner, you were tweeting up a storm. You were videoing up a storm. Is that
you are? You are our eyes and ears, Ben Wagner.
And our camera. before we let you go to happy hour at the House of Beers, what did you make of Mr. Pearson's outing today?
First off, don't give away all my secrets, okay? Let's not do that.
Okay. Well, the Dunedin Brewery, I know, is a Tuesday staple, so I just figured House of Beers was the Monday
staple.
You
got to break it up.
Yeah. Now we're talking about my rotation and not the Blue Jays rotation. Yes. Let's focus, guys. Focus. Hey, listen. What I saw from Nate Pearson a little bit was what we saw early in his major league start after we got 2.0 done and then we got into the regular season. Fastball command is a problem for Nate Pearson right now, and he was missing up and away. That's the arm slot side. We saw him fighting it last year. We saw some of the same mannerisms even this year in his first go around with this outing today. The velocity for a guy that did have some injury concern last year, that's not going to be a question. 99.9 on the radar gun at the ballpark here in Dunedin. That's impressive. We love to see that. But it was also a ball, and it missed up and away. So there was a lot of good to take away from it. There were some bad things and some things that you would probably just scuff off because this is outing number one.
Pearson said last year, look, I was trying to paint the corners too much rather than be on the attack. He said, I want to have more competitive pitches and want to be on the attack. Are you getting the sense that that's kind of the game plan for him over the next month, Ben?
Absolutely. And I take that two ways as well, because Nate wants to be a guy that goes right after guys, pound the zone, lower part of the zone, whether it's right or left-handed hitters. But something that Buck and I noticed as we were sitting yesterday and watching the ball game in Tampa, and then I was paying particular attention to it today, how did Alejandro Kirk, how did Reese McGuire set up behind the plate? And there was way less shifting behind the plate today and yesterday than we ever saw last year from the Blue Jays. And that shifting right and left, they were setting the target basically in the middle of the plate and letting the stuff from the pitchers do all the work. And I don't know if this is going to be something that we're going to see throughout the course of the regular season, but I know in the pitchers' meetings where they were discussing how to throw more strikes, that was one of the things that the players were telling the coaches and baseball operations people, that let's not try to be too fine. Let's let our own stuff play. So they came away with this game plan, stop moving inside, outside. Let's put the target right down the middle, and let's see how our stuff can play.
That's interesting. Now, Reese McGuire, I've always thought, he is quieter, you know, behind the plate than Danny Jansen is. Like, I don't think he's a great defensive catcher, Ben, but he is pretty quiet back there in by nature, I think, isn't he?
He is, and he's way more compact, which is interesting because we talked with Danny Jansen earlier in spring, and he told me he wants to be a little bit more closed with his legs and let the hips kind of dip below the plate. Now, the Blue Jays are going down to that one knee thing, and we saw a couple of guys do it yesterday, saw it today as well. They're fine giving up stolen bases with people on base because they want to buy strikes. But Danny is trying to close up his catching stance and be a little bit more compact like Reese.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about, you know, you just talked about throwing strikes. Obviously, you know, that has been Robbie Ray's bugaboo. That's what turned him from being a very good front of the rotation guy into somebody who was a bit of a reclamation project. From what I could see today, Ben, he did, you know, he threw gas, right? But he threw fastballs, he threw strikes. One of them got turned around pretty good. But what did you see from Robbie Ray's outing?
I saw fastball command, which is good. And yes, Anthony Alford took him straightaway center field. In the first inning, he allowed two very hard hit balls, but they were ran down in right, the first one and the second one in left. But for me, early in camp, what do guys have in terms of command? And command was there with the fastball. He threw a slider, just a couple of changeups. So he tinkered a little bit, but what he was doing, he was pounding the strike zone. And that, of course, is what unraveled with his new body, his arm slot, once camp got rolling in Arizona last year. So this, to me, knowing that he adjusted how he would train coming into spring training, use spring training then as a springboard for the regular season in hopes that he would have more life on his stuff as we play out what should be 162. That's the good news for me, that even with this kind of new approach to it, that it's all planned out with this extra time to work with the Blue Jays, it was check box number one and walk away very happy pounding the strike zone.
Yeah, one thing that Ray talked about in his Zoom call after was he was also pleased with a slider. He said, he got it over for strikes, and he said that now becomes such a weapon for him, and that's going to be a big part of what he's going to be. Ben Wagner's with us from Dunedin, was in Tampa yesterday for the Blue Jays and Yankees, and in the house for the Pirates and the Jays today. Let's just close the book on Pearson before we let you go. How do you see them, the Blue Jays, using him now, Ben? Is it every fifth day? Do they want to get him into different scenarios? Will he be starting any game? Do you have any sense of how his usage is going to be now?
Concrete, no. But the plan right now is to throw him as a member of a standard rotation. That's every fifth day. And he's got to prove that he can do that, I think, before you really start to get creative with him, because that's dangerous in my mind, where you didn't have the consistency last year and already outing number one, be it spring training, you didn't see him go out and attack batters like he did early in camp last year before the shutdown. This, to me, is Nate Pearson's got to pitch himself into the conversation and also earn a shot to throw every fifth day.
Through 98 and 99 today, it is windy, it is cold, we had snow flurries today. Make us jealous, Wagner. What are you looking at right now?
What am I looking at? What am I feeling right now? I'm feeling temperatures at 27 degrees. The wind has died down. The sun is glimmering off the Gulf of Mexico. And it is just a absolutely pristine backdrop.
Thanks, Ben.
Nobody likes him. Nobody likes you. Just so you know. Thanks for the time, brother. Good to hear your voice again.
Hey, we'll talk soon.
Yes.
Right, we'll see you guys.
There's Ben Wagner from Dunedin, where it is much nicer than it is here. The Ray thing's interesting. Look, they brought him back 1 year, decent money. They just want him to eat up innings.
Yeah, and it's, you know, this is a Pete Walker thing, right?
Yep.
That Pete Walker believes, and he believes in Pete Walker. And look, we are not that far removed from Robbie Ray being really, really good. So, you know, this is not a guy at the end of his career. This is a guy who went off the rails, you know, as Ben alluded to, mostly in last spring training when he tried to play around with his arm slot and he lost a bunch of weight and he got messed up and never really got it back. But boy, if they can get him on track, Arash, it's a different conversation about that rotation.
Our text line has erupted. We're going to get to some of them in a minute. 590, 590. Give us your name and city. And also, with the Leafs playing the Oilers tonight, outside of Matthews and McDavid, let's take away the star players from Toronto and Edmonton. If you were to start an NHL franchise today, who would you build around with? Who would be your number one overall pick in an expansion draft if there were no protected players? Text us 590-590 with your name and city. We'll read that coming out of the break. But first, when we return, he was the two-time manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. He had the unforgettable strut to the mound, and he was never shy with his words. John Gibbons will join Brunt and Medani after this on the Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Danny and Brunt with you until 7 o'clock. It is a game day. The Maple Leafs and the Oilers go tonight. It's 10 o'clock Eastern. Sportsnet Ontario, Sportsnet East. Love it for you on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Hard to believe it was 10 years ago yesterday, Canada winning the gold medal, the golden goal. Sorry, 11 years ago yesterday. Sidney Crosby beating the Americans in overtime. Chris Pronger, who was on that team, he's going to join us coming up. But first, let's welcome in our, I was going to say our good friend, but maybe our arch nemesis might be the better.
No, we'll always be good friends.
John? Steven, hey, you know, the only reason I'm doing this show is because Steven's not here.
Thank you.
I haven't talked to him in so long.
Hey, Gibby, how you doing, man?
Since when did it? I'm doing good, Steve. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm all right.
John Gibbons joining us from Ted Cruz's plane on the way to Cancun. I didn't know they had phones on those airplanes. I thought that was very 80s or 90s, Gib.
Hey, all I want to know is, do these guys not have, I don't care what party you're in, do these guys not have AIDS? Or, you know, all these people working for them can say, hey, the optics of this isn't really going to go over well. This isn't going to look good, you know, or maybe his wife, or maybe even the individual kind of think that. I don't get it. You know, I don't get it because I like Cruz, you know?
Yeah, I did think of that. It's, no, it's sort of like, you know, this is why you need good friends, Gibby, because, you know, when you get a terrible haircut or you wear horrible clothes and you go to your friends and say, hey, how do I look? And if they say, you look great, those people aren't your friends, right? So you need somebody to say, no, don't leave the dog staring out the window and go to Cancun. This is a bad thing. People are, you know, people are having a tough time here. Hey, how did you, how are things for you guys during the power outage, blizzard, cold, everything you guys went down through down there?
Oh, Steve, it was brutal, man. This is nothing to you guys, but this, I mean, we lost our water for 4 days. You know, a lot of people lost their power. And, you know, I think they put up those big old wind turbines, man. Those things froze, so I don't know how good those are. So,
that's the problem.
All I can tell you is I did a, you know, I heard Chris Pronger's name a minute ago. I did a couple of banquets. I think it was two winters ago. One of them was with Pronger, but then another one, I went out to Moose Jaw. It was 50 below zero in out the prairies there. So this, actually, this was nothing down here except we had no water.
Yeah.
Nope. Is that where you learned to shovel?
Yes. Hey, you know, manual labor never scared me. Maybe you ought to try a little bit of that.
Quit
being such a pretty boy on the TV and the radio or whatever.
John Gibbons with us. Yeah. You know, Steve mentioned, hey, you want to have a couple of confidants tell you don't rock that haircut or whatever. When you were playing or you were managing, who kind of was your confidant? Who provided a little sober second thought for you in the dugout, John?
Well, you know what? Well, naturally, the bench coach, DeMarlo, Butterfield, you know, when Butter was there, Butter was always kind of a guy I would lean on, or he'd never hesitate to you know, to make sure you're in line and things like that, or you're thinking straight. And, you know, most of it probably, not a lot of it necessarily goes on during the game, you know, unless you're discussing strategy, but, you know, a lot of pre-game or after the game, if this or that happened, or they might, because, you know, we get blinders on, you know, we can all get blinders on, especially in the baseball business. And sometimes you need that output from somebody else to say, wait a minute, that's not it, because, you know, and you see, that's very important. Now, so some people are stubborn. They don't think that's valuable, that information like that, and that's, I think that's a big mistake.
Yeah, no, I think having a sounding board for sure. We all need them. Gibby, I know you got the gig with the Braves, but it's a weird year. It's another weird year we're into. What's your work life going to be like this year?
Steve, that's a great question. You know, I've spoken with my bosses over there a couple times, and they're everything. Unless you know, even with the major league team right now, or in those, I guess you could say, vital positions, It's still kind of up in the air with the schedule, what the league wants or going to allow, or what the, you know, each individual organization, you know, is willing to do at this point. You know, I think they're just getting, but it's, you know, it's kind of like the minor leagues. You know, everything's kind of some things are on hold a little bit, and trying to figure some things out. So they said, just sit tight. You know, we'll have something for you, because I did it for about a month last year, and really enjoyed it, loved it. And then when they took everybody off the road, it was boom, dried up, you know. And it's and I miss it. You know, I finally got a chance to go back out there and watch some baseball, which I hadn't, you know, for a year at that point. And then now it's another year, you know. So what are you going to do? You know, it seems like things are getting better, though. I mean, you know, with the vaccine and stuff, and let's just hope it's not that much longer.
So are you major league scouting or minor league scouting? Like, what's the job?
Yeah.
That's too specific, right? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It was a tough question. I know. I'm sorry, John.
You know, that is because I'm not sure I can answer that question if you don't know the truth. So, you know, I'll put it this way. What they had me do last year, you know, they had me go out and look at amateurs, you know, the college and high school kids for the for the draft, the junior draft. Mainly they had me look at that guys that might go high, the high picks, you know. The ones that there's no doubt they're going to be high picks, and they would, you know, so I wouldn't screw them up, you know, with my evaluations. But
right.
And you know, but I enjoy going back to the roots and seeing the enthusiasm and the young kids and all that, and then boom, everything stops. So I assume I'll do depending on how long this lasts, I'll maybe do a little bit more of that. They said, you know, go out and look at some of the affiliates and maybe go look at a big league game. To do what? I'm not sure exactly. Then maybe I'm sure they'll give me some instructions.
Yeah, that's an interesting part of the draft because, you know, college football went and college basketball is going, but there are a lot of high schools, there are a lot of colleges who just aren't playing baseball right now. I just wonder how do you do your evaluation if you're a big league team and there isn't, you know, somebody hasn't really played much baseball in the last, you know, 13, 14 months leading into this year's draft, I wonder.
Yeah, you know, Arash, you know, it's like, you know, everybody's, you know, they're stagnant now, you know, they're stale and the development has been hindered, you know, and who knows how that affects guys. You know, it's crazy, you know, nobody really has any idea of all, you know, what this COVID thing is doing for not only the sports world or, you know, you look at the kids in the country that can't go to school, you know, it's almost like some lost valuable time for them as well. You know, you don't know the effects of that. You know, so sports is minor compared to that stuff. But, you know, it Major League Baseball, I mean, they'll figure it out in a few years from now. They'll figure out just how difficult it was.
Yeah, John Gibbons with us here. Arash Madani, Stephen Brunt with you until 7 o'clock. John, you just missed Nate Pearson. He's the new one that everybody's got their eye on, and Pete Walker is the one working with him. You and Pete were attached to the hip for a number of years. What is it about Pete when it comes to developing a pitcher, a young pitcher, that you were most impressed by?
Well, you know, Arash, you know, first off, pitching coaches, they have to have a good eye and be able to break down the mechanics and things like that. And most all of them do that, you know, very well. I think what separates the good ones is the you know, Pete gains the confidence in these guys. You know, it becomes deeper than just a you know, working relationship. You know, these guys like him. You know, they'll go to him for things, not only baseball, but, you know, maybe some personal stuff too. So, you know, he wins them over that way, you know, and they know he can be trusted. And he's just a confident guy. You know, Pete's always positive. You know, he'll pin your ears back if you need a little bit, but he's that feel good type guy too. So, you know, they might come out of a bullpen session, or they might be in the clubhouse looking at a video or something. And, you know, they come out there with their chest sticking out. You know, Pete's always had that knack. And, you know, he played for me back in the minor leagues over there with the Mets. Pete did. And you know, he even had it then, you know. I mean, he was just one of the good guys. So I think that goes a long way. And the big thing, I think, is trust. And he's good. You know, he's had some good ones in the past.
Yeah, because I was wondering, you know, when a guy with pitching coaches, and obviously there's a lot of there's a lot of technology involved now too, right? So they've got all kinds of data that's being fed to them. But how much of it, you know, when you send a pitching coach out to the mound, how much of it is talking to a guy about his release point or, you know, his arm slot or, you know, technical stuff or where his foot's landing or something like that, and how much of it's between the ears? Like, a lot of it's got to be getting a guy to do something that he's done his entire life, right, to be successful, kind of get him back into the right mindset to do it again.
Right, and you know, Steven, I mean, they're all different. You know, he may go out there with one guy, and it may be a mechanical thing. He said, "Hey, you know, okay, you're dropping your arm, or you, like you said, you're hitting your heel, you know, your foot's laying in the wrong place. I mean, that's very rare, because usually those are such short meetings anyway. It's usually a vote of confidence, or hey, this is how you want to pitch this guy, or maybe an emotional thing. Let's go rev it up, that kind of thing, or you know, get your tail out between your legs, and you know, but it all depends on the individual. And you know, some guys you go out there and you get on them, and you know, you end up crushing them. So Pete's got that, you know, great feel for who needs what. And, you know, they always – very few of them didn't respond. You know, when I look back at my career there with Pete, you know, I mean, he always seemed to get the best out of those guys.
You still following the Blue Jays, Gibb? Keeping an eye on them?
A little bit.
Yeah.
I'm not
a lot of the guys are gone, aren't they? Who's left? Teoscar's left. And
– yeah, hey.
Not many.
Where'd Teoscar go?
No, I'm saying Teoscar is still there, but who's left from your time there? A lot of the guys are gone.
Yeah, Brucky. Brucky right. Was there, but briefly at the end. Danny Jansen. Yeah, there's not many. You know, they got a good young group though. You know, it's they spent a little money this offseason, you know, which is big. You know, bringing Springer in. So it should be an exciting year, you know. That's why you wish everything could get back to normal, you know. And you get some legit. Everything would be legit, and everything would be, you know, balanced, and you know, none of the crazy home road stuff and all that, you know, some normalcy. But yeah, they got some good young players, and they mixed in some good veterans there too.
Well, Gibb, we got to run, but. I'm not lying when I say this. Always good to hear your voice.
You got to run. You got to run. When's the last time you did run?
Hey, you haven't seen this guy lately, man. I'll send you a picture.
Steven, I heard, man. I need a picture. I don't believe it. David, what happened with the fishing, man? You been able to fish at all?
Yeah, that's all I did.
Or what?
Oh, that's, you can fish in a pandemic, right? There's nobody around. It's perfect. Yeah, I fish plenty, but, you know, I didn't get to go to some of the places I would normally go. So I am...
Yeah, you will, though.
I hope
you'll
so, man.
You'll get to
it
again.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm missing Florida
this
year. See you, Gibb.
All right, John Gibbons.
All right, you guys be good.
You too, John. Stay safe. There's John Gibbons, former Blue Jays manager. He's the best.
Yeah, no, needless to say, one of our faves.
Yeah. We weren't going to get into pucks with Gibby. Our text line's open, 590-590. Give us your name and your city. And who would you build a hockey team around right now if you could pick anybody other than Matthews and McDavid? It's Toronto, Edmonton tonight. A lot of people are chiming in. Nathan McKinnon, hands down.
Mm-hmm.
Troy from Acton. Mitch Marner, says Warren from Newmarket. Adam from Shelburne echoes Nate McKinnon. I don't blame him. McKinnon's a Nova Scotian. We all know how much we enjoy that. Mike from Welland says Nate. He's got 5 good years left. Wayne from Toronto, he adds the center of the universe, says Zach Hyman. So there you go.
Love that.
We expected one of those. We will ask Chris Pronger the same question and read more of your texts. 11 years after Canada won gold in Vancouver, Pronger, who was on that team, will join us when we come back after this. Leafs Oilers coming up tonight, 10 o'clock Eastern, Sportsnet Ontario and Sportsnet 1. You can listen to it right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Arash Madani, Stephen Brunt with you. If you're starting an NHL team today, you can't take Matthews, you can't take McDavid. Who do you pick? If you're Seattle and no player can be protected, who's your number one overall pick? Our text line's open, 590-590. Kevin from Medicine Hat says, Dreisaitl or Marner. He says, I personally believe Marner is the best player on the Leafs. Eddie from Toronto says, probably Nate McKinnon, because I think he's just a slower version of McDavid. Jeremy from Moncton chimes in, I would pick Nathan McKinnon, a Maritime boy. Amen to that. We'll be reading your text as the afternoon goes on. It was 11 years ago yesterday in an afternoon where basically all of Canada stopped. The gold medal game on the afternoon of the closing ceremony of the Vancouver Olympics. Sidney Crosby, the golden goal, and Canada had itself its second gold medal in three Olympics. Defenseman on that Team Canada roster was Chris Pronger, who joins us now. Chris, thanks for the time. We'll get to memory lane in a moment. But as somebody who has worked at the league office and as a team executive, if you have the number one overall pick in the expansion draft and no player can be protected, who are you building your team around if Matthews and McDavid are not available?
You'd be hard pressed not to go with McKinnon or Draisaitl just because you got to build up the middle.
Yeah.
You need to build strength up the middle, goaltending, defense, and then obviously centers. And you know, when you take in the current game in today, not 10 years ago or what have you, but right now, yeah, I would take either one of those guys, and probably would take Draisaitl.
Just you would, huh?
A little bit bigger, a little, you know, probably more durable, face-offs and things of that nature. But you're not going to go wrong with either one of those guys.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure there's a wrong answer there.
Yeah.
But you're right about the way the game is, because I was kind of like, and again, not to overly flatter you, but I'm going to, Chris. Like a Chris Pronger-like figure, if I could, you know, if I had a true number one defenseman, like, I'm still not sure that I wouldn't start there. I'm not sure. I'm trying to think who that would be right now would be unequivocal. Like, I'd say this guy could be a foundation piece. Could you do it that way?
Yeah, but I think you have to look at what currently is available from a defensive standpoint, who is in their prime or about to be. I mean, you might look at a Makar.
Mm-hmm.
You might look at, you know, guys, you know, in that age bracket, I don't know if you look at what you'd be passing on to get that high offense, high octane, but from a defensive standpoint, killing penalties, you know, playing that prototypical number one shutdown pair. I don't know if he's there yet. And I don't know if that's even going to be his type of game.
Yeah.
You know, he's obviously a highly skilled offensive defenseman, that, not to say that he's bad defensively, because he's not, but you know, a lot of his game is centered around moving the puck and jumping into the attack.
Chris Pronger's with us. Finish this sentence, Chris. Victor Hedman is the best defenseman in hockey since? You can say me.
I would say over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
No, I don't know if I'd use a name, because, you know, I think he's been stretches during the season, during some of the last few seasons, he's been very good. And then for, I don't know if it was a lack of mental acuity or just a, you know, he would waver and, you know, make mistakes that a player of his caliber shouldn't. And so, you know, last year he put it all together. You know, he's obviously a formidable, you know, great skater. You know, to be that size and be able to skate that well and to be that strong, you know, there's very few players that have that package.
So Rash mentioned the Olympic anniversary was yesterday, the Vancouver gold medal game anniversary. That's why we've got you here. You know, like, it seems to me, it feels like a million years ago and yesterday. You know, it is one of those weird time travel things. But when you think back on that day, Chris, what's the first thing that comes to mind for you?
Well, I think pride, number one. I think pride and pressure. You know, I think there was a great deal of pressure on that team to win at home in Vancouver. You know, from a Canadian standpoint, if we win and seal the deal, it's the most gold medals Canada's won in an Olympic game, Winter Olympic Games. You know, all this, you know, the storybook ending. And I think it's that team, along with O2, the way we didn't start the best, but we ended with our best. And the group came together and the team really banded together. And from a chemistry perspective, from a stylistic style of play, and just the way that the team bonded together and really rallied around one another. You know, I think when you're in those tournaments and it's, you know, a 2-week, 3-week span, there's not a whole lot of leeway for struggles and finding yourself and finding combinations and things of that nature. And so, you know, when I look at that team and what we were able to accomplish, you have a goalie change, you've got some, you know, moving pieces and obviously tough loss to the U.S. and people questioning, you know, whether you can do it, whether, you know, all the rest of that. So from that perspective, I think just so many factors playing in and home and having a lot of friends and family able to be a part of it, to maybe not be at the game, but a part of the celebration afterwards and dinners and things of that nature that you can kind of share and, you know, they could see the gold medal and kind of see everything that experience encompasses. So you're able to share it with a lot of friends and family that typically when you're at an Olympic Games, you're not able to.
Chris Pronger with us. Chris, it's the thing about the Olympics is when you're in it, those 3 weeks, those 4 weeks, it feels like you're in the most insane bubble ever. It feels like that's the only thing going on in the world because there are so many people from all over the globe there and everybody is in one city and that's all everybody's kind of talking about. When you're in that environment, it's different when you're, you know, even in the Stanley Cup playoffs, you're going home. You have off days where you can go do whatever it is you want to do, but everybody's in that kind of bubble. When you are in that, how immersed do you get into the whole scene of what's happening around you?
Well, I think that's the great thing about the Olympic Games is that you are able to immerse yourself in it as much as you want to. You know, obviously, you know, you get some of the, you know, Summer Olympics, some of the, you know, some of the teams, they stay off on their own. They don't participate in the Olympic Village. Or they have in years past. And you know, I think that's a great part about the Winter Games and how we've kind of done it from a hockey's perspective, immersing ourselves into the village and, you know, meeting all the other athletes and you know, seeing their greatness and how they train and what they eat and how they prepare for their various events. And, you know, it's impressive. And to be able to see, you know, you think about some of these people have literally, they're at the Olympic Games for 2 minutes of their event.
Yeah.
And it's make or break. They either excel and have the ultimate high of, you know, whether it's a gold medal or a silver medal, bronze medal, whatever, they want a medal. And then they're done. You know, sometimes it's on the first day of the games and then they're done for the next 14. So it's, you know, I think for our sport, it's a little bit nicer to kind of get yourself acclimated and ease into the Olympic Games and kind of feel your way through it and not have to like come in with a bang and, you know, it's a quick hit and then you're done. And, you know, so you're able to kind of get to know some of the other athletes from your country, from other countries and really kind of get a feel for each game seemed to have its own buzz and, you know, there's always storylines that you're able to follow and be a part of. So it's from that perspective, it's a great learning experience.
Chris Pronger with us, the Hockey Hall of Famer. So, Chris, you left the Panthers. You were the Senior Vice President of Hockey Operations. You left last summer, and you got into the travel business.
I did.
Wild time to get into the travel business. What do you have cooking up there?
Well, we're chugging right along. It's we've used COVID and kind of everything that's been going on around, obviously, travel and I know in Canada there's not a whole lot going on, but here in the U.S. and some parts of the Caribbean and Mexico and whatnot, we've used the time really to help build out our staff and continue to train and get everybody up to speed on how we operate, obviously from phone calls and networking and Zoom calls and all the rest of that with clients, prospective clients, suppliers, all the rest of it, really just use the downtime to really take advantage of that and use it wisely to better ourselves and work on the processes and different business ideologies and business plan and things like that. Really just trying to hone everything so that when we come out of COVID and come out on the other side of this pandemic, we're able to hit the ground running. And, you know, as one client said to me, there's going to be a lot of revenge travel.
Mm.
And, we're poised and ready. We're poised, ready, and willing to take part in that action.
Revenge travel. I like that. I like that theme. Chris, appreciate the time, man. Always good to catch up with you. And hard to believe it was 11 years ago, Crosby and the Golden Goal. But thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. That's wellinspiredtravels.com. Don't you forget it.
Won't forget it. The revenge travel is hopefully coming up sooner than later.
I'm ready for that.
There's Chris Pronger. What's your first trip, Runt?
Somewhere warm where I can walk a beach with my fly rod.
Yeah.
Search for something. Or maybe to the Gaspé to chase some salmon. It'll be fish related.
As somebody who lived on the road, Super Bowl was a tough one not being there. But yesterday, that first spring training game, I'm like, man.
Yes.
I miss Florida. Medani and Brunt with you until 7 o'clock. We are taking your text 590-590. If you were to start an NHL franchise today, the Leafs play the Oilers, take Matthews and McDavid out of the conversation. Who are you building your franchise around? We will read your texts. We'll be joined by Michael Grange coming up in a moment. What is the latest with the Raptors? They just had their game canceled against the Bulls. Is there another postponement coming? Tom Glavine, the Hall of Famer, will join us to talk baseball, and Chris Johnson on the latest. Auston Matthews is a game time decision tonight, and Michael Hutchinson gets the start in net. Why? CJ will tell us as Medani and Brunt return on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Tim and Sid is done. Tim and Friends debuts next Monday. Until then, Arash Madani, Stephen Brunt with you from 5 to 7 here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Leafs and Oilers go tonight, 10 o'clock Eastern on Sportsnet Ontario and Sportsnet 1. Blue Jays tied the Pirates 2-2 in a game that went 6.5 innings today.
The traditional distance, 6.5.
If that's not a COVID final score, I don't know what is. And we're taking your text, 590-590. Give us your name and your city. With this being maybe Matthews versus McDavid, Austin's a game-time decision tonight. Outside of those two, if you were starting an NHL team today, who would you start with? Who would you build around? Tanner from St. Catharines says, I'd have to pick David Pastrnak or Nate MacKinnon. Pasta is probably one of the best characters in the NHL. Certainly is. Nate from North York, Sid the Kid, hands down, even at the age of 33. You want to build around him. James writes in, talking about Matthew Barzal from the Islanders.
I'm surprised that Pronger didn't jump on that Victor Hedman a little more. He's a Victor Hedman skeptic. Who knew?
I'm stunned.
Yeah. Because he's if you're going to say the current version of Chris Pronger, not the same player, but a legitimate, honest to God, number one defenseman, that's Victor Hedman,
mm-hmm.
right?
No question.
And yeah, he was, maybe it's because he worked for the Panthers and their Tampa and there's a thing or something. I don't know.
Would they have played against one another in a best on best tournament?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. But I think Victor Hedman's a pretty good choice, actually.
Yeah. So we know the Leafs are playing tonight. We know the Jays are back at it tomorrow. What we don't know is when the Raptors are going to play. Scheduled to play the Bulls yesterday, gets postponed. The official reason was the Raptors didn't have the necessary 8 players to go. They're scheduled to play tomorrow against the Pistons. People around Detroit are skeptical that may play. And then it's Thursday, March 4th in Boston before the All-Star break. And the question now becomes, will the Raptors play a game at all before that week-long break? So to answer some of those questions, Michael Grange is with us from Sportsnet. Do you have any kind of inkling, information, insight into any of this, Grange?
I don't really. It's been amazing. It's been one of those terrible days where you just sort of start texting people early in the morning and sort of stay near your phone the entire day and end up at the end of the day with not much more information than you had when you started.
Yeah.
The one thing, I just retweeted this, Aaron Rose, who covers the Raptors for SI.com, he just, did the old flight tracking thing. And typically in the NBA, and it's true in the NHL as well, I think, is if you're playing on a Tuesday, you'll leave the previous market, your home market, on, say, the Monday afternoon. So typically, you know, Detroit, the Pistons would be leaving 3 p.m., arrive in Tampa 5:30, relax in Tampa Monday night, and then play. So, you know, I was trying to figure out if that plane had taken off, and turns out it was canceled. So there were planes. This is from Aaron's nailed this down, but can't say 100% that it's the Pistons plane, but it's one that has all the same movements as the Pistons plane would. So it's been canceled, and then they've got a flight rescheduled for tomorrow afternoon, which would get them in around 5:30 for a 7:30 game. That seems awfully tight. So I presume if they do play, it would be one of those ones where they move the time back. But, you know, I have talked to some people, and you know, no one can say anything definitively, but the sense is that there is more than, you know, we do know that there's been one coach that, you know, I reported this on Friday, that did test positive. Pascal Siakam was already ruled out for the game last night, and Adrian Wojnarowski from ESPN had reported that he'd already been ruled out all week. So, look, I don't want to give the guy COVID, but it certainly seems that, you know, it's more than an inconclusive test. So, you know, and I have talked to some people around who are kind of suggesting it is beyond those two. And that's what's really critical, because, you know, the team was last together as a group before they knew anything about any COVID situation Wednesday night in Miami. There was an off day. Would have traveled back that night. There's an off day Thursday. Siakam came to the arena, had the inconclusive test, went straight home, so he wasn't around the group. We know the six coaches weren't around the group. And so you could almost convince yourself that if nothing had turned up Saturday, Sunday, now today, Monday, that, you know, they only need eight players, that they might have enough to play on Tuesday night. If there has been subsequent tests, positive tests among that group that was working at the arena Friday night, again, and that went over Houston, then that would seem to me, it would be a pretty high hurdle to be able to play on Tuesday.
Yeah. And I just wonder now, if you can't go tomorrow, wouldn't it make the most sense just to whack Thursday's game against Boston, make sure everybody's in the clear, and then just let's reassemble after the All-Star break? I know it's already compressed schedule. I know you're trying to get all your games in, but at this point, I mean, what's the most overused term in a COVID world? Abundance of caution.
But the protocol's going to rule there, right, Mike? Like, this is not it's not anybody's call. It's the protocol's call. That's
right.
If that makes any sense, right?
Yeah. The phrase I was going to try and use was, we haven't seen a lot of examples of games being canceled prophylactically.
Not bad.
Well
not
done.
Bad.
Yeah. Well done.
Right. So, in other words, like, I don't think, like I said, there is, as you point out, Steve, there are protocols that they do follow. Obviously, they're kind of still being worked out in some degrees because this is also new. But if you go to that example where the Nets and Raptors played, and Kevin Durant was out of the game, then in the game, then out of the game. Mm-hmm. And that was all based on protocol. And there was a person that Durant had been exposed to, not within the team, but outside the team, who had an inconclusive test. And based on that inconclusive test, the protocol says if a player's been exposed to someone that's inconclusive, they can, and then their own tests are negative, the players, so in this case Durant's, then they're good to go. But what happened in the course of that game was the individual that Durant had been in contact with subsequently tested positive for COVID. And so then the protocol is, okay, so if you've been exposed to someone who's positive, you've got to be removed, and that's why he was pulled out. So there are kind of these guidelines that they're following, just like everyone's like, well, why did they play Friday night? That was ridiculous. Well, they need eight players, and everyone except one had two COVID tests the day of the game, including hours before the game, and had come up negative for COVID. So based on the protocol, you're allowed to play. And so as it relates to Tuesday and even Thursday, I think that they're just going to keep plowing along, hoping that they can get as many games in as they can. Because, Arash, if they were really to be anything other than a little bit aggressive, if they were truly acting cautiously at all times, they wouldn't have played very many games this year, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the whole thing has been a high wire act. And I actually commend them. I mean, I think it's remarkable. I think they've played 450-something games, and they've only had 31 postponed, given the entire circumstances around it. I mean, I think that's pretty good. So I think that we're just going to be in a wait and see mode, you know, right up until they know they can't play the games.
Mike, in normal course of events in the NBA, on an off day, would they have to disclose kind of player status in terms of injuries, like because it would come up in that circumstance, right?
Yeah, that's another good point. So there's a 5:30 injury report, and as of your phone, you know, me picking up the phone here, the Pistons had submitted their injury report, and the Raptors had not. So you know, I think there'd be an expectation they would, but clearly, I think things are pretty fluid based on. You know, so you could either read that very positively. In other words, they haven't had a bunch of definite positive tests Saturday, Sunday, Monday, because they would have been tested this morning. They have had some positives, and they're just trying to do contact tracing, because if you've had direct contact with someone who's had a positive, then you're out. You're into the protocols, and you're out about seven. You're out 7 days, I think. So maybe it hasn't been posted because it's all just so fluid. They can't write the names down fast enough.
Now, obviously, this is a health and safety story at the moment. It is, and from a basketball point of view, other teams have had their schedules disrupted and have already gone through this. The Raptors have been pretty fortunate so far, but if they have to wedge those three games into the second half, what are the implications schedule wise, Mike?
Well, it just gets tighter. I mean, and it's not all that much. The problem is sort of everyone's in the same boat. I think they played 34 games. They have 34. They have 38 left. Right now, they'd be, because they've had one canceled, so they're looking at 37. If they get all this whole week wiped out, they'd be trying to play 41 games in 66 days, I think. No, sorry. My math is bad. 38 games in 66 days. That's what it is. 38 plus. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, that's right. So it's intense. But, you know, like other teams are in the same boat. Like, I think the Spurs have had at least 5, maybe 6 canceled. The Wizards have had 5 or 6 games postponed, I should say. So, it's they're kind of the exception, and I think if they get out of this with only 3 games being postponed, I think they'll probably end up being on the light end of it. And the life the league has chosen, and the reasons are all pretty much financial. But the players can't complain too much, because they benefit significantly. The more revenue the Raptors, I would say the more revenue the league can avoid losing directly benefits the players as well.
Well, Grange, tell you what, we're on till 7. Brunt and I have our phones beside us. If you hear anything, fire us a text. We'll give you all the credit on the air, and we'll report it, because as fluid situations go, this is as fluid with a capital PH as you get. Thanks for joining us, man, and filling us in on the latest, which doesn't sound like a lot, but seems like a lot.
It's the
world in 2021.
Not knowing anything and trying to know stuff. That's my new job.
So. There you go.
A lot of us do that. Thanks, Mike.
When Grange was talking about tracking the flights, it took me back to May of 2015, sitting in the bowels of BMO Field waiting for an Argos ownership announcement, when suddenly the flight tracker had a private plane, the MLSE private plane, leaving Detroit's airport, destination Toronto, Mike Babcock on the aircraft landing in Toronto. That's where my mind took me. The Pistons reportedly, I guess, Aaron Rose of Sports Illustrated saying that the Pistons plane, their flight was canceled to Tampa. Detroit's supposed to play the Raptors tomorrow.
All arrows pointing to that game not being played.
Yeah. Due to protocols, we're still waiting to hear from the Raptors on anything. As for the Leafs, they are in Edmonton tonight. Auston Matthews, a game-time decision. Michael Hutchinson will start for the Maple Leafs. We'll explain why when we return. But first, Tom Glavine, the Hall of Famer, the Cy Young winner, the World Series champion, to talk baseball, to talk Blue Jays, and talk the dreaded CBA when Madani and Brent return on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Danny and Brunt with you until 7 o'clock. It's a Leaf game night in Edmonton to face the Oilers. Love it on Sportsnet Ontario, Sportsnet 1, and right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. If you are starting an NHL team, if you're Seattle, and they can only and teams can only protect Auston Matthews, Connor McDavid, who would you build your franchise around? We're taking your text, 590-590, give us your name and your location. Gabe in Grimsby chimes in and says, I'm taking Marner in my draft, hands down, so much versatility. Reg chimes in. He says, being from Nova Scotia, living in Ontario now, I am still going with McKinnon. And how about Tori from Toronto? He said, I'm not chiming in on that. He just said, I'm just here to say we all miss Gibby in Toronto. Hashtag Gibby the best. Great to visit with the Blue Jays manager a little earlier this afternoon.
Yeah, hard not to love Gibby. He's a pal. We both like him very much.
We certainly do. The Blue Jays tied the Pirates 2-2 in 6.5 innings today. That's what went on in Dunedin.
Yep.
Very much a 2021 COVID kind of start to spring training.
Highlights, Robbie Ray threw strikes. Anthony Alford hit one of them out for the Pirates. Nate Pearson was 98-99 all day, but struggled a little bit with command. Any other highlights I'm missing here?
I think that's about
Rowdy Tellez had another hit.
Yeah, George Springer is going to DH tomorrow and lead off. He's making his Blue Jays spring debut tomorrow.
Oh, and Austin Martin made his Toronto Blue Jays debut, made two errors at shortstop, walked and stole a base.
Hmm.
There you go.
There you go. Forget Blue Jays in 30. That was Blue Jays in 45.
And it was not a representative lineup. Let's put it that way.
Yes. We're thrilled to welcome in a man who needs very little introduction. If we're going to give him one, let's go Hall of Fame inductee into Cooperstown, not Toronto, but was drafted ahead of Luke Robitaille and Brett Hull. So, Tom Glavine, I know you're in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. If you were drafted in between Luke and Brett, would that have meant you would have been a Hockey Hall of Famer too?
I mean, it stands to reason, doesn't it?
Right.
I would think
just,
so.
It's logical. You're right. It's just logical.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
When was the last time you you put skates on?
Man, it was I guess right at the start of COVID. I guess before everything kind of shut down. I was still up in Atlanta and doing my Tuesday, Thursday morning skates with my buddies and. Once everything kind of got shut down, that was the end of that.
Yeah. Is that the one Mike Soroka's part of, Tom? Like, you skated with him, haven't you?
Well, he wasn't a part of it, but I skated with him at that rink that I skated at in the mornings. But no, he had a heart attack trying to get on skates with me. He didn't do it. So, he would have. I don't think the Braves would have took too kindly to him coming out and playing.
Do you have any idea how he's doing on his long road back, Tom?
I've not heard much recently. I know, you know, earlier this winter he was throwing and doing all those things. And, you know, I don't know that I've seen anybody put a timetable on him, which I understand. I mean, I think the biggest thing you got to do right now with him is be patient. You know, whether he comes back, you know, April 15th or May 15th, you know, it doesn't really make a difference other than you want to make sure he's 100% healthy and ready to go. So the Braves are going to be cautious with him. They're not going to push him. But look, he's a young kid and he's a hard worker. So he'll be back probably as soon as possible, I would imagine.
Tom Glavine with us. Tom, Atlanta was such a great story last year, what they were able to do, their run in October. And I'm of the belief in sports that it's a walk before your run deal. You know, San Diego got a taste of it. The Dodgers ended up knocking them out once they got a taste of the postseason. Atlanta had already been there the year before. They had, you know, that meltdown in Game 5 against St. Louis. They had the Dodgers on the ropes, and L.A. found a way to get it done. After all of that, where do you see this Atlanta team that likely will get Soroka back, that brings Marcelo Ozuna back, in a National League that's stacked, the arms race is in the NL this year, where does Atlanta figure into this equation there?
Well, I think they've got to be one of the top three or four teams at worst. You know, I think anytime I always felt like, you know, when you're reigning division champions, you're the team to beat in your division at a minimum. I think the Dodgers are the team to beat in the National League because they're the reigning champions in the league. So I think you start there. No question. There's been a lot of movement in the National League this year. A lot of teams got better. You know, obviously San Diego made a huge splash, but, you know, the Mets were busy. Philadelphia was busy. You know, Washington, they still got a pretty good rotation that's always going to put them in the mix. So, look, it's going to be tough, but, you know, I think they are one of the top three or four teams, like I said. You know, they lost some guys. They added some guys. Obviously, their most important signing was holding on to Ozuna. So they're a good club, and I think that their experience the last couple of years in the postseason is only going to help them. I think they look at the Dodgers as being the team that they have to conquer, so to speak, and that's no disrespect to anybody else. I mean, at any given year, somebody's going to come out of nowhere and be a force to be reckoned with, and that's what's always great about baseball. There's always that team every year. But I think they would view the Dodgers as the team that they have to get over the hump on. And you know, for them to take them to a Game 7 last year, I think was really important for them and for their psyche to make them believe and understand that they can play with the Dodgers. So I think their experience in the postseason the last 2 years is only going to help them.
That's the voice of Tom Glavine, the Hall of Famer class of 2014. Steve.
Tommy, you mentioned the Mets. You know, what do you think, what's that, you know, it's a bunch of interesting things about that team. One is, you know, that within that division is going to be crazy good potentially, but you know, they're also in a year when almost no one spent, they were one team that went out there and was really aggressive in the marketplace, you know, in the middle of COVID, but also, you know, in advance of, boy, and I hate to talk about collective bargaining, but we will at some point, in advance of, you know, a new CBA potentially after this season. You know, what do you think that Mets team is going to look like on the field? And again, what do you think about, you know, that really there was only, you know, two or three teams this entire offseason who were active in the free agent market?
Yeah, look, I mean, they wanted to make a splash, obviously, with a new owner. That new owner wants to come in. He wants to make a splash. He wants to let the people of New York know that, you know, he's in it to win it, and he's going to do everything he can to win. And he certainly went out and made a splash. There's no question about that. Like you say, they were one of, if not the most active teams this winter. So, you know, he's trying to send a message there. And, again, not only to the people of New York, but certainly to the guys in the clubhouse that, hey, you know, I'm in this thing to try and win, and I'm going to try and give those guys in that clubhouse every opportunity to do that. But, you know, I think the big thing with the Mets is it just seems to start and end with health. They've had a hard time staying healthy, it seems, for the last 4 or 5 years, particularly that rotation. And any time you got Jake DeGrom at the top of your rotation, you got something special. Now, can the rest of those guys fill in and stay healthy and play major roles? I don't know. Like I said, it's been the kind of thing that every year it seems to have been an issue for them. Can the back of their end of their bullpen figure things out and become the back end of the bullpen that I think they thought they had a couple of years ago? So, you know, those are all questions that are going to have to be answered. I mean, you can look at, I think with every team, you can look at what you've done on paper, where you've improved, but then at the end of the day, you have to go out there and do it. And I think the Mets are one of those teams that I think for the last few years, people have looked at and thought, okay, again, with that rotation, their lineup is solid. you know, they could be a team that they would have to be contended with, and then things just seem to fall apart. So I think within the Mets organization themselves, they're going to have to prove to themselves a little bit that, hey, we can go out there and we can do this and we can be a good team and we can stay healthy. So there's a little bit, of, I think, of an internal dynamic there that they have to deal with. But, yeah, I mean, I think, again, on paper, with everything they did this winter, they're a team that could certainly make a splash. Now they have to stay healthy and well do it.
Tom Glavin's with us. Tom, look, you know the drill. In your era, inevitably that Atlanta staff, you and Maddux and Smoltz, just kind of intertwined and linked together. Now we're just seeing a completely different approach organizations have, be it for analytics, be it for high performance departments, sports science, to the way starting pitchers are being used. Maybe some of it is salary suppression too. Maybe a big part of it is salary suppression too. What do you make of how the starting pitcher is being used in the industry and how quickly that has shifted?
I mean, look, I think I've been pretty, I don't want to say outspoken, but I think pretty honest about it. I don't like it. I don't like the way starting pitchers are used today. I don't like the way the game is going in regards to starting pitching. And, you know, you look at some of the things that go on, and I don't blame the pitchers, so to speak, completely, because this is what they're brought up in. You know, like I've compared it to, you know, my generation. You know, we had some good pitchers. We had some good numbers. We did all those things, but we didn't have the numbers that the generation before us had. I mean, we weren't going out there and making 40 starts a year. We weren't going 300-plus innings like, you know, the Nolan Ryans and guys of that generation did. But we were groomed differently. You know, we were groomed under the pitch count. We were groomed under, you know, at that time, maybe a setup man and a closer. So your mentality was to try at a minimum to get to the eighth inning and hand it over to the setup guy and then hand it over to your closer. So, you know, you saw changes in how the game was managed a little bit in my day. And I think you've just seen a bigger progression in today's game. You know, these kids today are brought up under the notion that they're not going to make 35 starts a year. They're not going to be allowed to flip a lineup for a third time. They're being told that they can't do that, that the numbers say they can't. And, you know, if you tell guys, you know, they can't do something, well, that's kind of going to be what it is. And so I don't think it's all their fault. I do wish that organizations would get away from that. I do wish organizations would say, you know what, we're going to give you a chance to flip a lineup for a third time and see if you can figure out how to do that. We're going to give you a chance to pitch in a tie game in the sixth inning and not necessarily go to our bullpen. But, you know, that's been the evolution of the game. And look, on the one hand, I get it, because if your starting pitcher, you know, is starting to run out of gas a little bit and you've got a steady flow of guys that you can bring out of the bullpen that are throwing 95 to 100 miles an hour, I get it. You know, it can be an easy choice sometimes, but I think from my standpoint, I would like to see organizations start to resist that a little bit, to start to fight that a little bit, to try to start grooming starting pitchers to get deeper in the game and flip lineups three times, maybe even, you know, a complete game a little bit more often than we see today. So I don't love it. You know, I think you see teams using openers simply because they don't have enough guys to be starting pitchers. And that's their answer to that problem. If trust me, if the team had five guys that were capable of going out there and being starting pitchers, they would run five starting pitchers out there. When they don't, then they have that opener and try to piece together a game or two games out of every five, whatever the case may be. But it's just kind of sad for me to see the decline in both the quality and the importance of the starting pitcher in today's game.
Tom, while we got you here, I do want to ask you one question about kind of the state of the business and the state of baseball labor. You were so involved with the PA back in the day, including around the 94-95 work stoppage. It feels kind of grim right now, to be honest. You know, it was hard to get to that 60-game season last year. It was a fractious negotiation between the owners and the players. There wasn't any compromise in terms of this season. The players are skeptical, and then, you know, of the what the owners are saying, and, you know, then you have stuff like the Kevin Mather stuff in Seattle, and you understand exactly why they're skeptical. Not a ton of optimism necessarily about what happens after this year with with the contract. What do you see those storm clouds building, and what do you think the resolution is going to be here?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I do, just because I hear people talk about it. You know, I haven't paid a ton of attention to it, but certainly did last year when everything was going on. You know, it's funny that we went from, you know, one of the silver linings in my mind of the strike in 94 was it was the starting point for what has been 25 plus years of labor peace. And who would have thought that, right? I mean, it was inevitable every time there was a collective bargaining agreement, there was going to be a work stoppage. After the strike in 94, that hasn't happened. And I think in big part because everybody knew the damage that it did to the game, and they didn't want to do that anymore. You know, we've gotten further and further away from that. And as we all know, with everything in history, the further you get away from something, then the more you forget about it. And I think that's part of where we are. I'm surprised at times of the level of distrust between the two sides, because, you know, I know there's always that level of distrust. I mean, let's face it, the players are never going to buy what the owners are telling them when it comes to revenue, and the owners are going to swear that they're always telling the truth. And that dynamic is never going to change. There's going to be a level of distrust. I guess I'm a little bit surprised by what level it has gotten to. But look, I think the players certainly have reason to feel that way. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that they've been right. I was critical of them last year when they were trying to get things done. You know, it last year was an odd year. Obviously, a lot of things were going on and a lot of craziness in the world. And I just felt like both sides at times were a little bit deaf to what was going on in the world. And I don't think either side did a very good job of selling themselves in a public relations standpoint. Not that that's what it's about, but when people are losing,
but it kind of is. Yeah, it kind of is.
Well,
Tom.
It is. No, it is to some degree. I agree. I'm not saying that's not what it should be all about. But obviously, there's some dynamic that that's what it is about, because you're constantly, whatever side you're on, you're trying to sell your message and make people understand. And I don't think either side did a very good job last year of making people understand what it was that they were fighting about or why they were fighting. And I just think that in the environment of last year, where people were losing everything in their lives, and then you got these two sides, you know, fighting over seemingly silly things to the average fan, they didn't do themselves any favors. Now, can they be smart enough and get past that? I hope so. I mean, you got a whole season to kind of digest things and see where things are. But listen, I'm with you. I have no reason to believe anything's going to get better. I've heard too many people talk about how bad the relationship has gotten and that it's almost inevitable that something's going to happen. You know, I just pray, you know, like maybe in my collective bargaining agreement after the 94 strike, where we almost went down that road again, the cooler heads prevailed and we figured it out and we got something done. I just hope over the course of the season that, you know, they're able to have some conversations and figure some things out before it goes down that road again.
Tom, appreciate the time, man. Always good to visit with you. Appreciate the insights. Hope you're doing well, and look forward to catching up down the road.
I appreciate it, guys. Have a good night.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. That's Tom Glavine, the Hall of Famer and World Series champion with Atlanta.
Always one of the best interviews in baseball when he was a player. You always learn stuff from Tom Glavine.
Yeah.
Great guy to talk to.
And you make an interesting point, because when you think back to 94, he was front and center. He was the player representative.
Yep.
And he had no problem speaking his mind publicly about where the owner's stances were. He had no problem saying how egregious they were. And Glavine, what I really appreciated what he said there is that it was the greater good in the collective that he was after, even though he was a prominent player. And that's one of the toughest things, of course, in collective bargaining, when a small percentage of the players make the majority of the money. Glavine was looking not after just the upper class, but the others too.
Yeah, but it's going to be, we're in an unusual situation in many ways right now, but the point about memory, you know, like the guys who lived through those years with who played baseball in those years had memories going back, a lot of them, to the bad old days of the reserve clause, and understood the battles that the union had fought under Marvin Miller to get to where they were. There was a real sense of kind of consciousness about what where they had started and where they were. And that 94-95 thing was horrible, but there was a certain degree of inevitability to it as well. And then they, you know, sometimes like after a war, people say, you know, they understand that they don't want to go to war again because the memory is fresh and the damage of the memory of the damage done. This generation, both of owners and players, you've got aside from Jerry Reinsdorf, there's nobody who went through that.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the distrust on the player's side for sure. Like the Mather stuff, you know, kind of just put a bow around it, but they feel like that this marketplace has been suppressed artificially and they don't trust these guys. And that was evident getting to the 60-game season last year. And it was, it was evident leading up to this season when they tried to get 154, the owners only wanted to play 154. There is very, very little trust. And without trust, you cannot make a deal.
Yeah. And when Rob Manfred, when they finally decided on 60 games and Rob Manfred went on the Dan Patrick show and said, yeah, we were only going to play 60 games. That's all it was going to be.
Yeah.
That just drives the distrust going into this. And as much as fans hate CBA, labor stoppage, strike, all of those things, hockey, escrow, you just get the feeling that after this season, we're going to be hearing a lot more of that.
Yeah, and I want to talk about baseball and the smell of the grass and spring training, all that stuff, more than anything. And we're going to do lots of that. But if your favorite team isn't playing next year, it's best you understand why. You know, and it is, I hate to say it, but it is a possibility.
Yeah, and you look at Fernando Tatis's contract. He signs 14 years, $340 million. His base salary next year, it's $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
If that's not the canary in the coal mine,
yep.
I'm not sure
exactly
what is. We have Leaf game night tonight here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet Ontario, Sportsnet 1. The Leafs coming off probably their best game of the season in Edmonton on Saturday. Get the Oilers again. Auston Matthews, a game time decision. And Michael Hutchinson will start in net. Why? Chris Johnson will tell us after this. Text line is open, 590-590. Bradley in Toronto, listening from his hospital bed, says bumper music is on fire.
Hmm.
Bradley giving a little shout out to our man Dylan behind the glass. Bradley, hope you're hanging in. Hope you're doing better.
We can talk about it. Are we allowed to talk about the music, Dylan? I never know if we're allowed.
We're not on TV, so we can do whatever we want.
It's all Dylan except for John Doe. That John Doe is mine. But the rest is all Dylan.
Used to go to as many live shows as anyone I know. What have you been doing for your music fix?
I've done some of the streaming stuff, you know, on platform, like Sidedoor. The platform Sidedoor has had some great stuff. So shout out to those guys, Dan Mangan and Sidedoor, who do great work. I've been trying to support musicians, you know, that's by paying for stuff.
Mm.
Like that's, you know, because I'll tell you, many things are going to come back to normal before live music does.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of folks hurting, and there are a lot of tours that are written down in pencil right now for next fall, and no one knows. No one really knows what's going to happen.
I walked by the Horseshoe the other day. I was just thinking to myself, man, when's the next time that place may be packed?
Yeah. Yeah. Shoulder to shoulder in the Horseshoe does feel like something that from another time.
Yeah.
I would be very, very happy to be there doing that right now, crammed in. Having my eardrums further wrecked. The ones I wrecked back when I was in a music reviewer many years ago.
Arash Madani, Stephen Brunt with you until 7 o'clock. It's a Leaf game night here. We're not just talking music, talking a little bit of sports too. Text line open, 590-590. If there's one player outside of Auston Matthews or Connor McDavid you would start your franchise with, that you would build your team around, who would it be? Jerry from the Peg writes in. He says, Connor Hellebuck, got to stop the biscuits. That's from a 204 number. I figured that a Winnipegger would have something good to say about Connor Hellebuck. Karen from Mississauga says Carey Price, which is an interesting one. You think about Carey's resume, his age, Turns 34 this August. I hear you, Karen. That's what I kind of wonder about.
Not 2021 Carey Price, I don't think.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that there's, you know, Hellebuyck might be the closest thing to a goaltender where you'd, you know, where you're actually a goaltender who would make a difference all by himself. I know there's some great goaltenders in the league, but like Carey Price at a, when he was Carey Price, you know, I'm just not sure he's that anymore. And I'm not sure, and who would be the next one? You know, who else out there? Like normally that would be a, it's a great, you know, a great answer. It's like goaltender, build it from the goaltender out. If you had a goaltender who was as dominant as some of the guys we have certainly seen over the years.
Let's bring in Chris Johnston from Sportsnet.ca and Hockey Night in Canada. Who's the best goaltender? Who's the best goaltender out there right now, man?
Probably Andrei Vasilevskiy in Tampa, and not just because they won the Cup. If you look at some of the sort of the underlying goalie numbers, the sort of newer age stats about, you know, saves above expected, he tends to top the list. But even he, I think, what was he, a 2012 draft pick? Off the top of my head, he's about 26. You know, maybe you're building around him. Maybe you're betting on someone younger, Carter Hart in Philadelphia, Mackenzie Blackwood in New Jersey, you know, both of whom probably don't get a ton of public yet, but, you know, they're 21, 22. And certainly both, I would say, are in the conversation for Canada should the NHLers go to the Olympics in a year's time. So, you know, we're kind of at a weird spot, certainly with Canadian goaltenders, where those are probably the only two with the sort of promise we're talking about building a team around. But, you know, you're probably starting with Andrei Vasilevskiy if you had to do it right now.
It makes sense. I mean, because you know what you have. It's a known commodity. I get 27 this year is not a spring chicken, but that's prime of your career stuff. You should get at least 5 good years out of him, shouldn't you?
You should, but, you know, goaltending performance, you know, has a lot of variance in it. I think that's one thing that sort of confounds general managers is, you know, what made Carey Price in his prime so special, I think, is he didn't have too many what we might call down years. But, you know, you see a lot of goalies have great year, mediocre year, bad year, great year kind of thing. And, you know, I think obviously some of that is I think we're still struggling maybe to quantify what happens in front of the goalie in terms of, you know, obviously certain goaltenders. You know, if you played for the Leafs for the last 5 years, just as a local example, you've probably had a tougher time because it's not been a pretty, you know, very good defensive team prior to this year during that stretch than, you know, playing even in Tampa or Boston or, you know, places where, you know, they've been a little bit more effective in front of the goalie. So, you know, goalies in general are there's a huge debate, I think, about whether, you know, can you even run with just one anymore? Do you want to maybe rather than paying one of them, Carey Price or, you know, Henrik Lundqvist money, you know, maybe try and get $2-3 million guys and go with it. I mean, it's kind of a bit of a hot button issue, I would say, in the hockey community. And there's not necessarily consensus at this moment in time about how best to approach that.
Now, you've given me the perfect segue to talk a little bit about Saturday and look ahead to tonight. But the Toronto Maple Leafs on Saturday night, as airtight a defensive team as we have seen since, you know, pick your date, didn't take a penalty, shut down Connor McDavid. Without Austin Matthews, played as complete a 60 minutes as they played, and got a great, you know, really good goaltending performance from Jack Campbell, who I kind of thought would be in tonight, but, you know, maybe they're trying to ease him back in. What did you think of the Leafs smoting their latest challenger in the Scotia North Division, the latest one to test their superiority?
Well, I would say what's emerging for me is just that this team's really good.
Yeah.
You know, I'm prepared to say that now. I mean, you always want to hold off on these kind of things because, you know, it's a weird year. It's a weird schedule. We're only seeing them play 6 opponents and there's, you know, 30 other teams in the league. So it's tough to get a clear idea of where they stack up, but they're right near the top. Obviously they're at the top in terms of wins and points, but I think that they deserve that place in the conversation because, you know, they have sought to improve in very specific areas, such as shots against, scoring chances against, chances off the rush against, you know, and all these things are very measurable now. And they've made huge progress there while not sacrificing anything offensively, still having some of the bright young stars in the game. I mean, I think a combination of their approach, you know, probably starting with Sheldon Keefe right from the start of a season, you know, versus last year where he came in midway through or partway through. And you know, just maybe some of the, you know, to a lesser degree, some of the changes they made in the offseason. That kind of mix has the Leafs right now as, you know, a clear Stanley Cup contender, you know, I think more so than we could even say in the previous years. And so, you know, that performance to me, what it says is just, you know, this is real. You know, what we're seeing is real. They've won so many games with having to use three goaltenders. You know, tonight looks like it'll be the third game this year they played without Matthews. They played without Joe Thornton first stretch. Zach Hyman's missed games. Wayne Simmons has been out. I mean, obviously every team deals with injuries, but this is stuff that the Leafs in the past, you know, those kind of absences would have, you know, derailed their season for a week or two. You know, they're a machine right now. And no matter who they're playing against and no matter who it seems is in their lineup, they're finding a way to get it done. And I think that's the mark of a team that's really taken a step.
Chris Johnson with us, insider at Sportsnet and on Hockey Night in Canada. Okay, so we find out from Sheldon Keefe last week that Matthews had been dealing with the wrist for a while. Do you have any sense, Chris, on how they want to manage it? I know he's a game-time decision tonight, but, you know, there was a lot of talk at the beginning of the season. Will there be some kind of load management as a preemptive move, as a precautionary move? But now that somebody like Matthews is dealing with this, what's your sense on how they want to manage it, even if he can be fit to play, but looking at the long-term picture so it doesn't turn into something more serious?
Well, I think the long-term is what's allowed him, you know, not to play the first game in Edmonton. And you know, I presume he's not playing tonight. He did a long skate after his teammates, you know, the kind of indication you usually not, you know, working on the conditioning for 50 minutes on a day you're going to play the game. So, you know, I'm working on the assumption he's not playing tonight. And I think it's all dictated by the fact that they've been able to win without him, that they are head and shoulders above everyone in the division. And obviously that their goal is not to, you know, have Austin Matthews be really good on a Monday night in Edmonton. It's you know, to have him be what he can be when it really matters. And so I think that they have been able to take a cautious approach because of how things have gone without him and where they are in the standings. And so, you know, I think really that's where it's at. You know, as it was conveyed to me, all Austin Matthews cares about at this point is winning with the Maple Leafs. You know, the only, I guess, secondary part of this conversation could be, you know, removing him from these games if he could play. And I do believe he could play. I think he's probably healthy enough to play. It's just not worth the risk. You know, I think that's how they're viewing this. It's not as though he's physically incapable of gripping a stick or anything like that. You know, I think if this was a playoff game tonight, there wouldn't even be a question about him playing. But as I was saying, the only secondary question is, well, he can, you know, he's got these leading in goals. He's in the points race. I mean, if that stuff was important, I think he'd probably be playing. You know, I think he views that as probably the cherry on the dessert. You know, I don't think it's a must-have for him. I think he'd rather compete for the Stanley Cup. And so that's kind of informing the approach that he's taking and the team's taking to this issue.
I always thought the cherry on the dessert was a must.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that, you can't have dessert without the cherry.
Doesn't look like you've been eating much dessert lately, Rash. I don't want to tell
cherries.
You, but
too many cherries.
Every picture I see
TJ.
On Instagram, I feel like I'm looking back 10 years.
There you go. We got to go on that note.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for that, CJ. I appreciate it.
No problem. Be well, Steven. Good to hear from you guys.
Say, Chris.
All right, CJ. Chris Johnson joining us from Hockey Night. Look, it's going to be interesting to see how they manage him and manage it, because yes, they've missed Simmons, and yes, the gold and Anderson's out for a while and Joe Thornton, but Matthews is it. I mean, that's forget the cherry on top. He's the engine. He's the steak.
Well, without that engine or without the steak, they dominated a pretty darn good Edmonton team on Saturday night. And if they're that good, you know,
you're buying the Leafs here.
Well, I was buying them kind of early on, but I am, I am buying them this year.
Steve, this has been fun. We're here all week.
We're here all week. Try the veal.
Exactly. We're bridging the gap until Tim and friends for Boffo, Fabro, and Brown and Brunt. Madani saying good night from Toronto. We'll see you tomorrow.